I'm Jill Kindrick. I'm 59. Today is March 3rd, 2020. We're on the campus of New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I'm interviewing my dad, Earl Nissen.
And I am Earl Nissen, and I am 88, soon to be 89, on today, March 3rd, 2020. And we are in the KRWG station at the NMSU campus, and I am being interviewed with my daughter, Jill.
So, Dad, the reason I wanted to do this with you is because I think your experiences in Africa were interesting and people should know about it. But to start your military experience, you were in ROTC at Bowling Green. So how did you get into that?
Well, when I signed up for ROTC, it was voluntary. And I knew it would be a four-year program.
And what year was this when you started it?
I started at Bowling Green in 1949. So at the end of it, I knew I would be commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army, and that I would have a two-year active duty obligation. But before I did the ROTC, I did 2 years with the Ohio National Guard.
When you were in high school?
Yes.
In what town?
This was in Elmore, Ohio, and we would train at Camp Perry, Ohio. I was a tank driver, so I got to learn about how you can crush things with a big object.
So that helped you in driving in New York City when we moved
right,
there.
Right, prepared me. So then, but then I knew about ROTC, when I first started at Bowling Green, they recruited us. And out of that, we were trained to be artillery officers. And we did some time at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, during a summer camp. We learned more about forward observing and so on. So when we left Bowling Green, the Korean War had just finished.
In 53?
53. Mm-hmm. And I knew, well, they told us we would be getting orders, but they didn't know when. So I went out, and your mother and I took teaching jobs in Adrian, Michigan. And I didn't get to finish that school year because I got active duty orders in April, end of April. So I had to leave, and your mom stayed, finished out her teaching year there. And then that's when we went to Lawton, Oklahoma. And at Lawton, at Fort Sill, I was put on a team of officers to help develop the firing tables for a new secret weapon we were developing called a 280-millimeter gun.
It's a big gun.
Atomic, and it would fire atomic warheads.
Which was unheard of in the 50s.
That's correct.
Well, not actually unheard of.
Yeah.
Something new.
So anyhow, we take this big monster out on the firing range. And I was a safety officer one day, and I had command of the whole firing mission for the day. And even a general couldn't supersede me saying, you know, it's safe or unsafe to fire. So we kept firing different trajectories. And then all of a sudden, one was plotted, and I said it was unsafe to fire. And I was screaming this into a microphone, and there were radios out all around the big gun, and everybody heard me saying, you know, unsafe to fire. And all of a sudden, I heard coming back feedback on the radio that someone was screaming, fire the damn thing, you know, and I thought, whoa, wait a minute, who is it? So I picked up my binoculars and I looked down where the gun was, and there was a colonel telling the firing battery sergeant, fire it. And I'm screaming, unsafe. But the colonel rather threatened the firing battery sergeant, and kaboom, they fired it, and the round landed in a housing development in Lawton, Oklahoma. And it took out 8 houses, and thank God there was a rodeo going on in town, and all the people were at the parade.
Nobody was home.
Except in one house, there was a 72-year-old woman. And, I jumped in a Jeep with my buddy, and we got there just when the fire departments were arriving, and they found the elderly lady and hauled her off to the hospital because she was pretty beaten up.
Yeesh.
But it ended up, I had to go to a courts martial of that colonel who was drunk at the time, and he ended up getting 10 years in the Lompoc, California disciplinary barracks, and he was reduced to a lieutenant, and then that was it.
Well, I remember we were at a family reunion, and a relative of a friend of mine was listening to you, and my brother was there, and my brother recognized when you said something about a 280-millimeter gun because it was so unusual.
Yeah.
Turns out this guy, this relative of a friend, he was one of the enlisted men who was there that day who said, "We heard the safety officer," which was you, Dad, "say unsafe to fire." So he was one of the guys who got you out of the jail.
Well, he was at the courts martial after we started comparing notes.
Oh, that was, I mean, everyone just stood there with their mouths open while they were reminiscing about this crazy story.
And remember, we even went to that relative's church, and he stood up in church and talked about it. So
it's
that
a
was
small world.
That was the way my military career began.
Okay.
So, anyhow.
So that was Fort Sill, and then you went to Fort Lewis.
Fort Lewis. At the end of the Korean War, they brought the 2nd Infantry Division back, and that poor division lost, out of 18,600 men, they lost 9,000. And so it was our job to get new recruits into the division and build it back up by training artillery crew members and so on. So anyhow, I did my 2 years, and then I was determined to get my master's degree, so I went back to Bowling Green. And got my master's in 1957, and that's when your brother was born. And I went right to Columbia University to get my doctorate in September of 57. So I was there for one full year, and part of the next semester, and then we had that big automobile crash where my parents were in, and 2 people were killed, and it was just an awful thing. So I took a year off Columbia to help out with the family. But then when we got back, your mom was very pregnant with you, and you were born in March 31st, 1960.
And every year I thanked her for not having me a day later on April Fool's Day.
Yeah, right. So while I was at Columbia finishing up, we didn't own a house yet or anything, and her brother was now almost 3, wasn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we were at Columbia. I went to a recruiter for the Department of Defense Schools and talked to him. He gave me all the scoop on the positions, and I found out there was an elementary school principalship at Wheelis Air Force Base in Tripoli, Libya.
This was 1960. I was a baby.
Yes, you were. It took us 29 hours, because at that time there were no jets. They were still prop planes, and we flew to Libya and out of Norfolk, Virginia.
What did your parents think about that? I mean, they lived in Ohio forever, had never been 10 miles from probably the place they were born.
Well, when as soon as you say Africa, I remember my mother said, "Oh, my God, the natives will boil you." It was just kind of weird.
It was just so foreign for them.
I know. Well, we had to get a map out and find out where it was, you know. So anyhow, the base had about 30,000 Americans. It was a big a base for rotation of pilots in and out of Europe and United Kingdom to practice bombing and strafing on the Sahara Desert. And so they had a big high school, middle school, and an elementary school just for the military dependents. And so as soon as we got to Tripoli, I went in, the base was 14 miles out away from the city of Tripoli, right on the Mediterranean. And we had to order, the popular car at that time was the VW Beetle. There were about 10,000 of them, I think, at the base. They all looked alike. But that was the popular car. So I had ordered one in Tripoli, but the dealer gave me a loaner, a VW Beetle, had a base sticker on the whole thing. And so on September 20th, the school started, I think it was the 12th or 15th of August, as I remember. And the school, by the way, the playground was the Mediterranean Sea because it had a beach right outside
the school.
They
could go out school. On the beach for recess?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, how cool would that be?
We even had some days we had a water day where the kids would come in their bathing suits.
Shouldn't every day be water?
Well, it was so hot there. Oh, my God. It was really, really scorcher. But anyhow, on September 20th, I decided to go into Tripoli to see if our VW had arrived.
And so at that point, how long had you been in Tripoli?
Well, we were there only a month, about 6 weeks.
Okay.
And I'd gotten the school opened and got all the teachers squared away and all that. Well, we were on a roll. So, but I went into Tripoli and I'm doing this 14 miles through a couple little suburbs, like one called Sokoljuma. And I came back, and I was just going through Sokoljuma, and they had a big stadium there where the sheiks would bring their Arabic horses in and race them and so on. And you had to go the road. Then there was a road right along the back. The back of the stadium was right up to the edge of the road. And on the other side, there were villas with big high walls. And so I had to go down, and so I turned, and I'm entering almost like a tunnel. You know, got the stadium on one side and the big houses on the other side. And I was about halfway through, and all of a sudden, a bus backed out from the villas and right up against the back of the stadium, and I couldn't go anyplace. And then all I remember is seeing bodies, people running, never coming towards my car. And they pulled me out of the car, and then they proceeded to throw rocks and broken glass.
Well, they held you on the car.
Yeah, they stretched my arms out, spread eagle up against the side of the car, and then the rock throwers were, you know, right in front of me. And this went on for a little while, and they shoved the stick in my mouth and cut my tongue in half. And so I was bleeding pretty profusely. And then my eyes went shut because the rocks were hitting me and just closing my eyes, I'd kind of like pass out, and I'd fall down on the ground, and they'd pick me back up, and so on. So anyhow, I was down on the ground once, and a voice in very broken English said to me, "Stay on the ground, the police are coming." Well, all the roads around there were patrolled by military police riding tandem with Tripolitania policemen.
U.S. military police.
U.S. military.
Right.
Yeah, the Air Force, actually. So I heard the siren, and then I felt somebody picking me up, and I couldn't see anything, of course. But they got me into the base, and the last thing I remember saying was, "Wife and kids in Transient Hotel," and I passed out, and I was unconscious for almost 3 days. And they made an assessment of me. I had a skull fracture, brain concussion, and all the facial bones were broken and pushed in. So they made a decision. They couldn't do anything about me there, so they airlifted me to Wiesbaden, Germany.
And this was after 3 days, so Mom mm-hmm. knew about it already.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was... Yeah. Well, I remember when I was a kid and we were at your parents' house, my grandparents' house, mm-hmm. and somebody said something about Libya, and everyone got quiet. Mm. And you took me and Mirandy, my brother, into another room and kind of told, we had never heard this story before.
Yeah, I guess
so. Every time I hear it, I hear something a little new and terrifying.
Yeah. So anyhow, I got into Wiesbaden. And they had flown, because this was just the inception of plastic surgery at that time, 1960.
Got a lot of practice in on you then.
Right. So they brought a full colonel in from England, a doctor, and plastic surgeon, and they patched me up. I had to take my passport along so they'd make my face look something like I used to look like. And...
I think they did a pretty good job.
Yeah, they really did. I mean,
well,
it was incredible.
I think it's miraculous that you're alive.
Yeah.
And do you want to give credit to the person behind all this attack?
Yes, well, when I'm in the hospital in Germany, one night, I spent almost 2 months in Germany, and the CIA was investigating. And so one night a CIA guy came into my room and said, "Now I'll tell you what we found." That he played a tape for me. The night before I got beaten up, they had a rally in Sokoljuma. And they gave people bags of rice to come into the rally. And they got the crowd chanting, "One dead American, one dead American." And and the CIA guy said, "Well, we found out it was an 18-year-old rebel leading demonstrations against King Idris." King Idris was in charge of the country at that time. And this guy's name was Muammar Gaddafi.
He was 18.
He was 18 years old, and he was that influential already in getting people to go against King Idris.
Well, how precious was a bag of rice to those people? I mean, it's just sad all around.
Starvation was just unbelievable around there. So anyhow, I got better, and I got back. Well, while I'm there, the superintendent of the dependent schools came to see me, and he said, "You've got two choices. You can either go back to the States, or we have a principalship open in Lakenheath, England, at an Air Force base which has a big hospital, and you probably need more medical attention and so on." So you got your choice. You either go back to the States or to Lakenheath, England. So I called your mom. And I kind of joked with her. I said, "You know what? Why don't we go to England? If I get in a fight there, maybe I can talk to them."
You know? Talk your way out of it.
So,
well, and the thing about you getting attacked is you were the next American. It wasn't
Yeah, it was random.
Personal.
It was random.
Well, yeah, they were just waiting for an American to
It
come
wasn't
by.
Earl Nissen that they were going for.
Right, right.
So they wanted me to get out of there because it was an international incident. And by me being around there, it would remind others of, you know, what could happen to them. So so
you're ruining
that's what
it
we
for
did.
Everyone. Huh?
Hmm?
You're just ruining it for everyone.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So anyhow, it was really weird. They usually waited till there was a military air transport, Matt's flight, to get you to England. But they wanted me out of there in such a big hurry that they booked us on a BOAC flight out of the commercial airport.
What's BOAC?
British Overseas Aircraft, Air Company or whatever it is. And so here we are. They pick us up in a military station wagon, and they had a Jeep with a 50 caliber machine gun on it in front of us and one in back of us.
And you were walking and talking and
oh yeah,
you were okay-ish.
I was still in bandages, but I was okay then. It was okay enough to bring me back from Africa. I mean, from Germany back to Africa. So anyhow, this on a Sunday morning, here we go, and we get off to the get off to go on the plane. They drove us right up to the plane, and so we go up the steps, and they had cleared the whole first class cabin. And we had two armed guards with big guns. And here we get on. I'm carrying you. And Mom is got Randy leading him up the steps of the plane. So we get in there. And you could see all the people that were already on board. And here we are, the first class cabin, all by ourselves. You can see all these people
wondering
hanging out
the
of their
you
seats.
Are.
My God,
we
must have a bunch of terrorists coming in, the two soldiers with guns. So they flew us from Tripoli to Catania, Sicily, and then to Rome and to London. So we were in England by late that night. And so then we went to the American Officers Club to stay over until they got us to go. Well, the base was 90 miles north of London that we were going to. And so while I was in the hospital, all of our furniture, all of our belongings arrived, and we're sitting in Konex boxes on in a warehouse in Tripoli.
Because we weren't in Tripoli long enough to go into the house that we were going to move into.
No,
we had a
contract to move into Georgianopoli, which was an all-American suburb. Right outside the base, and we never got there. But I got back from Germany on a Friday, and on Saturday they took us to the warehouse, and they took everything out of the boxes, and we inventoried it all. They had it all scattered all over this warehouse. They put it right back in boxes and put it back on a boat for England. So our stuff was well traveled. And when we got to the Lakeneath, there were no housing available on the base. And I'm glad because we got to live out on the English economy. We got to live in a little town called Croxton. And we moved into a 640-year-old squire's mansion. And
by mansion, like, well, you know, I'm thinking Downton Abbey, but that probably...
Well, not quite. That. The guy had created three apartments.
Out of this mansion. Because I've seen pictures of it. And
yeah, made out of flintstone.
Okay. Yeah, it had thatching.
Yes, thatched roofs. And all the plumbing was on the outside because that was added. You know, the place had no central heating. We had these little Aladdin heaters and so on. So we lived there. And then I did another year, you know, and I said that I want to go home. So,
well, one thing I remember you telling me about all the bus drivers.
Oh, yeah.
That was so interesting.
Yeah, because the Lake and Heath base was a SAC base, they carried atomic warheads on the planes. And in case there was an attack, we had 1,100 kids in the elementary school. And there were all these Quonset huts, but they were called Nissen huts. And they were actually made by some real distant relative who, when World War II came along, they converted from making gymnastic equipment to making these Quonset huts. Because one day, I'll never forget, I was walking around with the British Air Ministry guy, and he's there to check the buildings and all this kind of stuff. And he kept talking. He said, well, this Nissen hut, look what they did here and all that. And all of a sudden he looks at my name badge and he says, what was your name? And it was really a funny experience. You know? But so it was interesting because it showed us a contrast. Living out on the economy, living in that old squire's mansion in that little town, it showed us a contrast between how the English people dealt with the military people, because I was a civilian. Connie, your mom and I would get invited to the Thetford mayor's wife's tea or something, but they wouldn't invite the military. It was a funny thing to observe.
Go back about the bus drivers,
The bus driver. Okay, since it was a SAC base,
what's SAC?
Strategic Air Command.
Oh, okay.
We had to be ready to move those 1,100 kids in case there was an attack on the base. So we had enough English buses. Like 25, 30 of them, something, I can't even remember. It was just the whole parking lot. And these buses had to be available on a moment's notice to move out all the kids. So the bus drivers had one Nissen hut where they would sit and drink tea and scotch. It was a nice thought of, you know, getting out and driving a bus.
Yeah, that's who you want, driving your children in an emergency.
So I used to go out and visit them every once in a
while. But you wouldn't drink.
No, of course not. Anyhow, they were a bunch of characters. They really had a good time.
But, I mean, you just don't think of those things. Like, I know. They had to hire those people just in case.
But we had to have one annual drill to do this. So there was an abandoned English army base up on the North Sea, which was about 45 miles. And the evacuation plan was all the kids on the bus, drive the 45 miles, and enter the barracks of the old abandoned English army base. And so I'll never forget that day, holy mackerel, getting all those kids on the buses and taking off. And I hope they hadn't too much, you know, tea and scotch. but we made it and brought them back. So anyhow, so then I came back to the United States and I did.
We weren't in England very long, though, were we?
2 years.
Oh, really? Oh, that long.
Well, about a year and a half, because we didn't get to England. It was just about Christmas time. I was in the hospital from, about the third week in September, and I think it was the first or second week in December when I got back. But we got into England in time for Christmas because we put up a Christmas tree. I remember doing that. When we came back, I was an elementary school principal in Caldwell, New Jersey. Then I did more time with in public schools all the way to being a superintendent for a short period of time. Never want to do that again. And so I, the next experience I had with the military was when we were living in New Jersey, or Nevada, which was part of the 38 years I put into public schools. But I then went from working as an assistant superintendent in Churchill County, Nevada, which is Fallon, Nevada, and I went to work for the Navy. There's a Naval Air Station in Fallon, Nevada. And what they, the purpose of that base is they would park an aircraft carrier either in San Diego or in Bellingham, Washington, and they'd bring all of the planes, 50 or 60 of them, to Fallon, and they'd stay there for 3 to 4 months to do training and repair the aircraft and all that. So then I got, I was the Child Development Program Administrator for the Fallon Naval Air Station. So that would be my fourth experience with military. So I had been in the Army, I'd been in the National Guard, I had been a principal of an Air Force school, and now I was head of the Child Development Program for a Navy base. So, and I had top security clearance, so I got to go to all the admirals' meetings and all. So it was an interesting experience at Fallon. And I left there in 1999. And then I came to where we live now, and I taught at Doniana Community College for 14 years. I taught a human development and behavior class that was required for nursing students. And so today I can't go in any doctor's office or hospital.
Emergency rooms.
Yeah. Without knowing, well, hello there, you know.
And my youngest was in one of your classes. She's now an RN in Colorado.
Yes, right. And we never told it was grandpa and granddaughter.
No, you had different last names. So.
Yeah. So it was good. So, but my funniest story about knowing people, I went in for a colonoscopy.
The
gal, you know, says, okay, go in here, take clothes off, and put you on this gurney. So they put me on this gurney to push me into the exam room. And so here you are, buck naked, you know, and okay, roll over on your side. So I'm doing that. And then I feel
really
a
good
slap on my butt. And this voice says, you didn't look like this in class.
Oh, lovely.
Which one of my ex-students.
Nice. It's a small town,
oh,
I tell you.
Oh, my God.
What.
The poor doctor almost dropped the scope. He's laughing so hard.
Well.
So, anyhow,
I thought with this interview we'd talk about Libya the most, because to me that was like just, it was such a huge thing. And
I know.
And I like to say I don't hate anybody, but I was not sad when Gaddafi died.
I celebrated. Well, I got the final thing about working for the Air Force at that time. I had to be interviewed by two psychiatrists at the Lake and Heath Base Hospital. And this was just prior to us flying back to the States. And
so they had like a debriefing? Kind
yeah.
Of?
I guess they wanted to see if I would PTSD or whatever, anyhow. The one psychiatrist was rather subdued. He didn't say too much, but one was very aggressive. And he started on me by saying, you have to be hating all Arabs after what happened to you. And I'm looking at him, you know, and I'm listening, he kept insisting on it. I said, no, that's not true. But he said, well, I can't understand. You're so traumatized by what happened, and all you do is see those Arab faces every time you close your eyes. I said, no, that doesn't happen. I kept insisting on this. And I even said to him, you know what? What happened to me could have happened on the corner of 125th and Broadway in New York City by some gang attacking me, you know. Well, this went on for about half an hour. The other guy made a few comments. And I just finally got up and said, F you. And I tore up the form that they had me ready to sign to say that I was traumatized by Arabs and so on. And so, you know, that was my farewell.
I know you and I have talked about this before, but I just wonder if he was baiting you to see if...
No, I know the difference.
Well, but I mean, why would he be so insistent? Maybe he hated
Arabs. I don't know. I had no comprehension.
I must admit, every time you've talked about this, you're very matter-of-fact about it. Like, I think I had a brush with death once, and... You're just happy to be alive, I think, is part of it.
Well, I know. I mean,
it sucks, but it could have sucked a lot worse.
You know what triggers me yet is hearing about somebody being taken as a hostage or something in the news, you know. I instantly replay getting hit by the rocks.
Oh, wow. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah. No, just happened a couple of weeks ago. There was something in Syria, and right away, you just replay it. But I don't hate Arabs. I mean, that was a bad bunch. But
and they did it for rice. I mean, just think of how they were taught as kids and what they were taught to believe in. And they thought they were doing the right thing, and how horribly sad and stuff like that still occurs. And
well, we were there long enough to learn a little about the culture. I remember the teachers one day wanted to have a coffee with all of the Arab women that worked in our kitchen. So we set this all up after school one day, and I'm sitting beside this young girl. And I'm talking to her, and at that moment, well, at that time, a health report had just been published by the Tripolitania government that the infant mortality rate by 1 year old was 60%. 60% of those kids died.
And by young girl that you were sitting next to, you mean she was 20s or something?
Yeah. And anyhow, I said to her, if this is true, why do your families have 5-6 kids? And I'll never forget this. She said, maybe one of them will live, you know? Oh, I still think about that. We think we have poor conditions in Juarez or around here, and nothing like the poverty and
it's everywhere.
How those people lived there. It was just incredible. And Gaddafi didn't help any.
Yeah.
Just think he went on for... He overthrew King Idris in 2007 or 8, one or the other. And then he stayed there. He was there 40-some years as the dictator.
It was before.
But he got his start on the streets. And I just happened to be there at the wrong time. But
well,
that was
I think
my
we need
story.
To wrap it up. But okay, Dad, thanks for sharing this, and thanks for all you did for all those kids.
Yeah, it was
being a principal. And
it was good.
Yeah,
some of those military families, those like some kids, by the time they're in fifth grade, they've been in 4 different schools. You know, they've been in 4 different locations, and so on. So you empathetically
they're used to moving.
Lived with all of those, and so and like. At Fallon, we had couples that were both F-16 pilots. So one of them would go on an aircraft carrier for 18 months, and then he or she would come home, and then the next one got. So those poor families, those kids had to live through all of that. So we dealt with a lot of traumatic events and so on. But anyhow,
playing the hand you're dealt.
We helped those Navy kids. I mean, it was really interesting.
Wow. All right.
So.
Thanks, Daddy.
All right. Thank you.
I love you.
Thank you for being my daughter.
I love you.
Me too.
And we just got to put in a plug for Mom. She was awesome, too.
Yeah,
I can't imagine
how
she.
About 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Dementia.
She had a lot to deal with, too. But, okay. Thanks, Dad.
So, how's that?
All right. Thank you, StoryCorps.
And everything I said is...